I went, and on nearing the official FS residence I met a rather well-dressed man. I saluted him most politely, and inquired if I could be shown the way to the Ponpo. "What do you want?" he asked. I explained that my son, a trooper from Seri Monastery, belonged to the party which had crossed Tongyi Yuk the day before, and that, owing to his bad foot, we had lingered behind, and were now making haste to join our companions, since we had no food. I then produced with affected shyness two trankers, to be offered, I said, to the Ponpo when my son, the Lama, came, which would bow very soon. At present he was inquiring at the gatekeepers about a bag that our friends should have left behind for us, and in the meantime I wished to beg Isolra. The man snatched the two silver coins, I expected this, and told me to wait. Then he went away. A few minutes later a servant brought me a small bowl full of tsampu and, from a distance, I heard the voice of the one who had taken my money commanding, "Take her down. It is useless for the tripper to come here." So the servant went ahead. What he said to the gatekeeper I do not know. I found the latter rejoicing proudly because Yongnan, whose mows were infallible, had discovered that our friends had not handed our dried meat to him. I deemed it wiser not to remain to investigate the identity of the man whom I had seen near the Zong. Once more we had escaped. We made haste to be off, which did not appear strange, since we were supposed to be anxious to overtake our party, and that evening we camped in a beautiful forest. Only the toll bridge of Jayamda now remained on our way. But this was still a long distance ahead, and we had time enough before us to devise some plan. I was heartily thankful for our lucky meeting with the party of travelers. In the first place, they had prevented the Papas from robbing and perhaps injuring us. In the second place they had made our crossing over the river Gong both easy and speedy. And lastly, although we were no longer with them, we had been able to make use of them to get smoothly through the Tongyi Yuk post. May they be justly rewarded for their aid. We were now nearing the end of the track which is called the Po Southern Road, a borderland region that joins the Kongbu Southern Road. It is mostly covered by forest, and villages are scarce. Although the inhabitants of that zone have no better name than those of the upper country, we passed through it without any trouble. The women of this part of Tibet wear, as do those of Po Yula, fur dress over which they slip a kind of large chasuble, made of bearskin for the rich, and of dark goat skin for the common lot. Both garments are worn, like all fur in Tibet, with the hair inside. Men also wear a scapula, but it does not reach farther than the waist, while those of the women fall nearly to the knees. What struck me was the sight of the women with black round felt hats of a western-like shape. Had these been trimmed with a ribbon, a feather, or a bunch of flowers, they could have been shown in the window of any millinery shop. More remarkable still were the mournful and pathetic tunes which I heard along my way. At first I was led to think that they belonged to some peculiar religious rites performed in the depth of the forest. But circumstances disclosed a less poetic truth. Hearing from a distance a slow, poignant, and really impassive dirge, I walked across the jungle in the direction of the invisible choir. As I progressed, my imagination already pictured a funeral or some still more dreadful spectacle. Slightly excited, as the traveler may well be on nearing an interesting situation, I strode through the thicket and reached the border of a clearing. There were the mournful singers, about 30 women clad in goatskin, wearing the national black felt hat. The work in which they were engaged had nothing of a dramatic character. They were merely carrying logs of wood which the males of their tribe had felled higher upon the hill, and the dirge helped them to keep step when the heavy loads were borne by several of them together. The words of the song were not especially melancholy. Where could that strange tune have originated? I never heard anything like it in other parts of Tibet. The women rested in the clearing, and a loud prattling took the place of the singing. Their gossip occupied the wood carriers enough to prevent them from noticing me through the foliage. I remained hidden, for had I shown myself I could not have avoided having to talk. Also, I should have heard no more of the song. After a while, the black-capped village girls and housewives got up, loaded their logs, and the melodious lament of their deep contralto voices spread again through the forest. I followed them at a distance as far as the path where I joined Yongden. While I was away, two travelers who were returning to the Gong district had asked him to make mose. He had just finished with these and had received his an orarium, some tsampa and two handfuls of dried apricots. When we emerged from the Po forests, we reached an open country formed by the wide intersection of several valleys. A number of important villages were scattered in this large area, which is partly cultivated and partly left as pasture land. The scenery is exceedingly beautiful and looks a little, but on a much larger scale, like some landscapes in the French or Swiss Alps. The region extending to the north is still unexplored. I felt very much tempted to undertake a scouting tour over the ranges which rose between the Tongyuk River and the Jiamda River. Time, unfortunately, was short. I should have to make haste if I wanted to be in Lhasa to witness the New Year festivals. I also feared to attract the attention of the villagers if I was seen wandering out of the main paths. What could I answer, in that case, when asked where I was going? In Tibet, no one roams for pleasure. Tibetans deem it absurd to walk if not compelled to do so by some definite business. When the people of the borderland hear about foreigners climbing the hills, traveling through distant lands or merely taking photographs, they cannot believe that this is done for personal satisfaction only. According to their opinion, explorers and tourists are all working for a salary paid by their governments. What sensible man, think the Tibetans, would take the trouble to move when he could remain seated at home? Only the necessity of earning money, or the desire to acquire religious merit, could induce them to do such a thing. Had I known the name of a monastery or of a zong situated in that direction, I could have used it to explain my journey. But I did not even know where to find the track which led to the opposite side of the range. I was not even certain that such a track existed, I only suspected it. Nevertheless, I started, but at night, in order to be out of sight when the villagers went to work in their fields the next morning. I reached a wooded ridge, descended it, and, having climbed another one, I came in sight of snowy crests. I had walked for 2 days, and could be nearly certain that I was about to reach the Jiamda River. On the other hand, I desired to see the Brahmaputra, and as I have just said, time was short. Too short to allow me to turn back south toward the Brahmaputra, after reaching the Jiamda River, and then having to retrace my steps to reach Lhasa via Jiamda Zong. On the evening of the second day, while Yongden boiled the tea, I was still pondering over the itinerary I should choose, when suddenly, like a ghost in an olden tale, a Lama appeared on the scene. We had not heard him coming. In fact, he did not seem to have come. One would almost have believed that he had just sprung out of the ground in front of us. Tibetans who wear Dokpa's boots with soft flexible soles do not make any noise in walking, yet there was something so unexpected, so instantaneous in the apparition of the Lama, that Yongden and I looked at him in wonder. He was dressed in the very plain garb of the Gompens, which is somewhat different in shape from that worn by the inmates of the monasteries. The tentreng was hung round his neck, and the long iron-tipped staff which he carried was surmounted by a trident. He sat down near the fire without uttering a word, and did not even answer our polite greeting. Yongden tried, but without success, to engage him in conversation. We then concluded that, according to a custom often followed by ascetics, he had made a vow of silence. This mute stranger, who looked at me fixedly, proved embarrassing. I should have liked to see him get up and go away, or do something that was natural to travelers, eat or drink. But he had no baggage with him, not even a bag of tsampa, which was an extraordinary thing in this country devoid of inns. What did he feed on? Seated cross-legged beside his trident, which he had stuck in the ground, he looked like a statue with only the eyes alive. Night had fallen. Was he going to stay? That he was ready, the enigmatic wayfarer drew from beneath his robe a skull fashioned to serve as a bowl, and held it out to Yongden. As a rule, into these lugubrious cups used only by followers of the tantric sects, no beverages except spirits are poured. My young companion made a gesture of excuse, saying, "Gompan, we have no chang, we never drink any. Give me what you have," replied the lama, opening his mouth for the first time. "It is all the same to me." Sunk again in silence, he drank and ate a little sampa. He did not seem to be going away, neither did he appear to want to sleep by the fire. Suddenly, without departing from his immobility, he addressed me, "Jetsunma," he said, "what have you done with your tentreng, your pasenten, and with your rings of the initiate?" My heart stopped beating. This man knew me. He had seen me dressed as a gompama, either in Kaam, in the northern solitudes, in Amdo, or in Tsang, where, I did not know. But his words showed clearly that I was not a stranger to him. Yongdan tried to prevaricate. He did not know, he stammered, what the lama meant. But the strange traveler did not give him time to invent a story. "Away," he commanded in an imperious tone. Apostrophe beer or barley spirits. I had recovered my sangfroid. Deception was useless. I could not recall this man's features or anything else about him, but as it was evident that I had been detected, it was better to brave the situation out, for this lama probably would have no interest in denouncing me. "Go," I told Yongdan, "light a fire for yourself a little further off." He took a handful of wood, a blazing ember, and went away. "Do not try to remember, Jetsunma," said the ascetic to me when we were alone. "I have as many faces as I desire, and you have never seen this one." The conversation which followed was a long one on subjects pertaining to Tibetan philosophy and mysticism. Finally he arose and, staff in hand, vanished like a phantom, as he had come. His footsteps made no sound upon the stony path. He entered the jungle, and seemed to melt away in it. I called Yongdan and put an end to his questions by saying laconically, "This Gompan knows us, though I cannot remember having seen him. But he will not denounce us." Then I lay down, making a pretense of sleeping so that I might be left undisturbed with the thoughts that my talk with the lama had aroused. Soon a rosy light spread in the sky and day broke. I had been listening to the mysterious traveler the whole night long without noticing how time passed. We revived the fire and prepared our humble breakfast. The nature of my conversation with the lama should have completely reassured me as to the possibility of denunciation by a man of his character. But my mind was overtired by months of painful watching and anxiety, and I could not entirely prevent fear from creeping back into it. I did not feel any longer inclined to continue toward the Jayamda Valley. By going forward in that direction, the strange Gompan had more or less answered my inquiry about the existence of a way across the range. Unless he was going to some anchoritic dwelling hidden in the recesses of the mountain, he would most probably descend the slopes of the Jayamda Basin. Moreover, though I had been deeply interested in our nocturnal talk, I preferred to avoid following in the steps of anyone who knew me. "Let us turn back," I said to Yongdan. "We will cross the Temo Pass and see the large Temo Monastery. You may be able to purchase there the warm dress which you need so badly." We went down again into the broad valley, followed it toward the head, skirting several villages, and finally reached the foot of the Temo Pass. I preferred it to the Naima Pass, situated to the southeastward, because the road to the latter has been surveyed, which is not the case with the track crossing the Temo. At dusk we reached a large well-built house that stood alone in the pastures near the river. In spite of its comfortable appearance, this massive building of grey stone looked rather disquieting. Perhaps its surroundings of densely wooded black ranges were responsible for that impression, or it was perhaps its greyish colour. Be this as it may, hospitality was immediately granted to us and we were led upstairs to a large and comfortable but dim room. Yongdan and I boiled some soup and we had begun to eat it when a lama entered, followed by the mistress of the house, who carried his few packages. We understood that we were to be given a companion for the night. This did not please us, but there was no way of avoiding it. The apartment in which we had been allowed to stay was the best after the host's private quarters. Traders returning from Lhasa occupied the other rooms, and in puttying two lamas together the housewife had shown courtesy to both. The traveler appeared to be a polite and quiet man. He spread out his carpet at the end of the room opposite to us. He then approached the fire to boil his tea. Politely Yongdan told him that he could dispense with that trouble, for soup was ready and we would make tea afterward. The Lama accepted the invitation, at the same time producing some bread and other provisions which he placed at Yongdan's disposal to add to the meal he was to share with us. Having done this, he sat down and began to eat. Tibetan custom required me to remain humbly at some distance, and I took advantage of this to observe from my dark corner the Lama taking his meal near the blazing fire. A gomthaga slung across the shoulders of his Chinese traveling robe, some other details of his dress, and the staff mounted with a trident which he had thrust upright between two boards of the floor on entering the room, revealed to me that he belonged to one of the Red Cap sects, most likely the Dzogchen. The mystic Dunkartanga lighted by the flames leaping from the hearth, cast moving shadows on the red wall. It brought to that commonplace country house something of the fascinating occult atmosphere of the Tibetan ascetic dwellings and reminded me of other anchorites with whom I had sojourned or whom I had visited on my way. It would have especially recalled the Gompchen to whom I had, a few days before, listened a whole night through, had I forgotten him, which was far from being the case. But aside from that symbolic implement, common to all tantric lamas, our new companion had nothing of the silent mystery of the one who had so unexpectedly joined us in the forest. He turned out to be a most pleasant and well-read literatus of the Kham province, quite ready to converse. At first I listened to him from a distance, as my disguise compelled me to do, but after a while, seeing that Yongdan could not follow his really very erudite and highly philosophical colleague, and that I should thus miss hearing the latter's view on a question which interested me, I forgot prudence and intruded upon the Lama's talk. The stranger did not appear astonished at the knowledge, quite uncommon for one of her kind, showed by the poorly dressed lay woman who seated herself before him. Deeply absorbed in his subject, he perhaps did not pay much attention to his questioners. We remained far into the night, quoting from the old books, offering explanations, referring to the commentaries of famous authors. I was delighted. But when I awoke, before the daybreak, the fear which had tormented me so much at the beginning of my journey made me tremble again. It was not enough that I had been recognized by the mysterious Gompchen. I had now imprudently shown myself well acquainted with Buddhist and Tantric philosophies. Perhaps I had made the Lama who spent the night with us suspicious. What a fool I had been. What would come of it? Should I reach Lhasa? It was in this cheerless mood that I began the climb toward the Tempo Pass, after having left the philosopher traveler still asleep in the Greystone house. We crossed the pass without difficulty, though the snow was rather deep near the summit. The road lay through woods all the way. It was good, but it is a long tramp from the top of the pass to the foot of the hill, on the slope looking towards the Brahmaputra. Temo, an important place with several gompas and larkangs, besides the large monastery, was reached at dusk. We pitched our tent in an out-of-the-way spot in the fields, when we felt confident that village people were shut indoors and asleep. The moon was full, the sky was wonderfully clear, and at the same time a bank of mist, about 10 or 12 feet from the ground, extended all over the valley and created the bizarre illusion of an immense veil shrouding the earth. After a peaceful rest I awoke early, or rather I thought that I awoke, for, most probably, it was only a dream born of my anxieties and of the recent meetings. The day had just dawned. I saw a Lama standing before me. He did not resemble Gompchen nor the literates I had left on the other side of the range. He was clothed in the white habit of the Reskyangs, his head was bare, and a long dress of hair fell to his heels. "Wetsma," he said to me, "at his dress of a poor laywoman, and the role of old mother which you have adopted, do not suit you at all. You have taken on a mentality proper to the part. You were braver when you wore your Zen and your Tentreng. You must put them on again later, when you have been to Lhasa. You will get there. Do not fear." He smiled with a sort of benevolent sarcasm. "Jigsmd Naljormunga means I, a fearless yogini," he quoted, from a poem I was very fond of reciting. I wanted to answer him, but now I really began to wake. The first rays of the rising sun gleamed upon my forehead, the space before me was empty, and through the open curtain of the small tent I only saw, far away, the shining golden roofs of the Temogampa. Most luckily, Yongdan found, at the very first place of call, all that he needed for provisions and clothing. It was quite time. His monastic dress was in rags, and now that we were out of the cover of the forests he felt the cold at night. He got an old lama traveling robe, which fitted him well enough. The material was of good quality, so that, clothed in it, my companion looked like a well-to-do pilgrim whose dress had been worn out during the journey. A kind man presented him with a goatskin for a carpet to sleep on, a luxury which he much appreciated. At Temo I heard for the first time some news which caused me great anxiety. The pension lama of Tashalumpur had fled from his residence. Soldiers had been sent to capture him, and what had happened afterward was not known by those who told us the story. The pension Tashi Lama, as I have explained in the introduction of this book, had been my host, and a very kind one. For years I corresponded with his mother, who never failed to send me, at the beginning of each winter, a pair of felt boots and a bonnet of yellow brocade which she had embroidered and sewn herself. How could it be that the mighty spiritual lord of Shigatse had become a fugitive? Truly, I did not altogether forget that he was far from being in good odor at the court of Lhasa. His avowed sympathy for China and his aversion to the military expenditures had greatly displeased the Tibetan king. I knew that on several occasions heavy contributions had been exacted from him, but I had never thought that he might be forced to fly from Tibet, where he is worshipped as the incarnation of a most high spiritual entity. Later on, I got some details about that truly oriental political drama. The story may be of interest. As years elapsed, the hatred of the Dalai Lama and of the court party, won over to the British influence, had increased against the Tashi Lama. He had been ordered to levy more money in his province and hand it over to the Lhasa government. People from whom I got these details said that the officials dispatched to collect it could not gather the amount required, and that the Tashi Lama proposed to the Dalai Lama to go himself on a collecting round in Mongolia, where his personal prestige might achieve the result which had not been attained by his envoys in the already impoverished villages of Tsang. This permission had been refused, and the pension Tashi Lama was asked to go to Lhasa. A new house was built for him in the park of Norbu Ling, the habitual residence of the Dalai Lama. I saw it, apparently unfinished, in a rather remote part of the estate. It was said that a jail was attached to the house, and that it was on learning of the imminent danger which threatened him that the Tashi Lama had run for his life with a few followers across the northern wilds. Did the court of Lhasa really mean to imprison the Grian Tiananmen, a large Tibetan province situated to the west of the province whose capital is Lhasa? The capital of Tsang is Shigatse, where stands the great monastery of Tashilumpo. The revenge of the court party on those who had sided with the Chinese after the latter had been driven out from Tibet seems to have been sometimes cruel. I have been told of a Grand Lama who, on account of his dignity as a Wattyalku, could not be openly executed. The poor man was imprisoned, and allowed to die of starvation. But the members of his ecclesiastic household, dignitaries of his monastery, were tortured, iron nails being thrust in their bodies day after day until death came. Is there any exaggeration in such stories? I do not know. At about the same time, a member of the high Tibetan nobility who as a state minister had supported the Chinese was killed at the Pukla. It is said that he was summoned before the ruler, who had just returned to the capital. There he was first stripped of his silken robes, beaten mercilessly, then bound, and thrown down the long flight of steps which go from the top of the Potala to the foot of the hill. He was still alive when he reached the bottom and was there executed on the post. His son, having heard about the dreadful execution, and foreseeing his own fate, attempted to flee, but was shot as he rode away. As a peculiar specimen of the Tibetan mentality, I will add that the widow of the unfortunate minister, his daughter, and his daughter-in-law, were all three given as wives to a favorite of the ruler who, being ennobled, received the title and the estate of the late minister. I deem it useless to give any name. The man who has taken the succession of the late Tibetan lord is perhaps quite innocent of his tragic end. I can state that, even now, more than 12 years after the victorious revolt against China, 3 high ecclesiastical dignitaries are still detained as state prisoners at Lhasa. One of those Lamaist dignitaries whom foreign writers call improperly incarnated lamas and living Buddhas. But to return to the Tashi Lama, whether entirely true, or even only partly true in its detail, the account of his flight, as I heard it, was really dramatic. For nearly 2 years, one of his faithful friends with whom I am personally acquainted had scoured the country disguised as a pilgrim in order to discover the roads that offered the greatest safety for a speedy flight. He had not yet come back from his last tour when the Tashi Lama, deeming that things had now grown too threatening to admit of further delay, left Shigatse hurriedly. His friend, the Lama Lobsang, arrived the following day. He ran after his master, but was compelled to turn back because of a fresh fall of snow which completely blocked the pass. Tibet was no longer safe for him. He crossed the Indian border, but his movements were known. Telegrams were sent in all directions, giving orders to arrest him. Nevertheless, he succeeded in sailing for China a few hours before the order to seize him had reached the harbor. As for the Tashi Lama, a Tibetan official in charge of a small iron, that of reading or another in the same region, had detected him amongst a party passing near his residence. Fearing to make a mistake, afraid also to lay his hands on the exalted person of G.D. Palmed, before whom all Tibetans, Mongolians, Manchurians, all Lamaists of Siberia and even of the far away shores of the Volga, prostrate themselves with utmost reverence, he dispatched a messenger to Lhasa to inform the ruler. At Lhasa, everybody believed the Tashi Lama was at Shigatse, and the inhabitants of that town, as well as the monks of the Tashi Lumpa Monastery, were not aware of his flight. When the official dispatched by the Dalai Lama had ascertained that the Tashi Lama was truly gone, 300 soldiers were mustered under Adipunga and were ordered to bring back the fugitive. But much time had been lost. The Tashi Lama and his companions had doubtless excellent horses. I remembered the large stable full of fine beasts which I unsighted at Shigatse, and could easily understand that the regiment reached the Chinese border after the Tashi Lama was safe on the other side. No need to add that the simple account of a political drama could not satisfy the mind of Oriental masses. The flight of the Tashi Lama was only a few months old when I reached Lhasa, only to find that it had already become a legend. After he had fled from Shigatse, said some, the Lama had left there a perfect likeness of himself, a phantom who acted exactly as he used to do, and thus all those who were not in the secret were deceived. It was only when the Tashi Lama was safely in China that the phantom vanished. But others told the tale in a different way. According to them, and they were many, it was the phantom which had fled to China, and the real Pendjin Rinpoche was still at Shigatse, invisible to his enemies, but visible to his far, faithful subjects and the pilgrim devotees. I was to learn all these details later on, but the first vague news received at Tema made me fear that my host was not yet safe. I thought of his good mother, my friend. What had become of her in that storm? This also I did not know, namely, that before her beloved son had fled, death had liberated the kind lady from all her earthly troubles. As I proceeded toward the Brahmaputra, brooding sadly over this strange event, a sudden memory came back to me. A little more than 2 years before, while I was staying at Jakyendo, a bard from Kham chanted for me the famous Tibetan Iliad, the poem of our King Jizer of Link. In the course of his recital, the man related to me some old prophecies connected with the coming of the Northern Warrior Messiah, expected by the Tibetans. One of them actually announced that the Tashi Lama would leave Tibet, proceeding to the north. I listened with the utmost incredulity, and jokingly asked him in how many centuries the event would take place. My bard, who was a rather enigmatic person, seriously declared that I should see the fulfillment of the prophecy, and that the Tashi Lama would leave Shigatse before 2.5 years had gone by. This seems to me still more improbable, even absurd, and yet there I was.